The following is a recording. We repeat. The following is a recording.
There's just a bulletin in from the Pacific. American forces have broken through the last Jap defenses in the Cagayan Valley, and General MacArthur has declared, Luzon is now liberated.
The All India Radio has heard a Japanese broadcast which says that Allied forces are attempting to land on an island halfway between Okinawa and the Japanese home islands. There is no word of such a landing from American authorities. However, if such a report is true,
fellow delegates,
may be a landing on a Mami Ojima.
The President of the United States of America.
Mr. Chairman and delegates to the United Nations Conference on International Organization. Oh, what a great day this can be in history.
Just a minute. Something's wrong here. Harry Truman isn't the President of the United States. There's no fighting in the Pacific. Luzon has been liberated for a long time. And the United Nations was born 10 years ago, not today. Yes, but that's just it. This isn't today's news. The voices you've just heard tell part of the story of what life was like 10 years ago today, June the 26th, 1945. This program will try to recall for you that day. There are some who will never forget that day. A great day. I'll be narrating, Gibson Parker.
United Nations Radio presents A Great Day. Recalling the state of the world and the birth of the United Nations just 10 years ago. A great day, with the real sounds of what happened and the actual voices of those who were there.
Morning, June 26, 1945. The sun rose early that morning into a cloudless sky. The young light tinged the peaks of the Sierra Nevada, crept down the western slopes to lift the night shadows from the land, stretched out over the orchards and the fields, and reached the sea. The rippled water caught the light and tossed it back, glinting. It was the dawn of a great day, but few in San Francisco were awake to see it come.
This is Charles Rodebaugh. I'm a newspaper man, one of the 1,500 who covered the San Francisco conference. San Francisco was jam-packed on account of the war. It was a mystery how all the delegates and the press and the secretariat could be squeezed in. As it was, they took a few rooms in this hotel, a suite in another, and a floor there.
The people and the buildings slept on. Only the regular early risers were abroad. A cable car ground slowly to the top of Nob Hill, laboring at the steep climb. The milkman discreetly placed his bottles on the doorstep. The newsboy on his bicycle pitched papers onto front porches with practiced skill. The wash and brush up men steering their cumbersome cleaners through the empty streets. The lone automobile parked at an angle on O'Farrell Street. San Francisco slept on. And in the Fairmont, the St. Francis, the Mark Hopkins, the Palace, in all the hotels and many houses, were men who had good reason for sound sleep. Late the night before, they'd finished 9 weeks of solid work. Delegates from 50 nations had drawn up a blueprint for the peace and well-being of mankind. The Charter of the United Nations had been approved. The delegates broke up to rest. For the next day, they'd put their signatures to that charter. And even as they slept, the words of that document began to exert their influence. According to press correspondent Alastair Cook,
I remember a crew of printers who had to work through 2 nights to print up the charter in time for the signing. There was trouble from some of them. And one Chinese-American printer said to me, I have a wife and family too. If the delegates mean this sentence, I work all night. If they don't, not. And the sentence he pointed to was a single phrase, the dignity and worth of the human person. Somebody told him they meant it, and he worked. He was the first man I ever met who, in the jargon, implemented the Charter of Human Rights.
11 a.m. Inside the two buildings, last-minute preparations for the great day. A few more licks at the yards of blue carpet. The washing and stacking of hundreds of plates for the last meals to be served the visiting secretariat and delegates.
I'm George Mardikian. I was in charge of all the food prepared and served to the delegates and the secretariat at the conference. We cooked the food in the basement of the Veterans Building and then transferred it through a tunnel to the restaurant set up in the basement of the Opera House. We had to set up an entirely new kitchen in order to feed 2,000 people at each meal. It was the biggest restaurant in San Francisco. It was during the wartime, you know, and we had our OPA headaches.
50 flags stirred in the breeze. In the court of honor between the two buildings, a military band waited for the cue to play. Shortly after 11, black limousines drew up. Smiling men got out, waved to the crowd, and went inside.
This is Charles Rodebaugh. Thousands of spectators were on hand to watch the world diplomats roll up to the Opera House in their borrowed automobiles. Both it and the Veterans Building were surrounded by the flags of the United Nations. Military police in trim white helmets and leggings guarded the area. There were anti-aircraft guns on surrounding buildings. It would have been a great feather in the cap of the enemy if he could have bombed the Opera House that day.
The people applauded each delegate as he arrived. There's Smuts of South Africa, Paul Bonnecourt of France, Molotov of Russia, Masaryk of Czechoslovakia, Padilla of Mexico, Romulo of the Philippines, Modaliar of India, Evert of Australia. After 9 weeks, the big names had become familiar faces to the people of San Francisco. The last car stopped. The last man went inside. The people checked their watches. It was noon. In a few moments, the ceremony of signing the new United Nations Charter would begin. The charter itself, printed in 5 languages and bound in blue leather trimmed in gold, lay open now on a large, round, blue-upholstered table in the center of the auditorium. Behind it hung the new blue and white flag of the United Nations, flanked by the multicolored flags of the 50 nations who would sign this day.
As it got near opening time, I changed my chef's uniform and went upstairs to the gallery. The delegates sat on the main floor, the press and the radio in the Diamond Horseshoe, and it looked like half of San Francisco was crowded into the balconies. There were people from every walk of life. I'm sure that the spirit of Franklin Roosevelt was there. Everyone around me whispered that he should have been there.
The delegation of China, headed by its acting chairman, Dr. V.K. Wellington Koo, took their places round the blue table. China, as the nation engaged longest of all in the fight against aggression, was chosen as the first nation to sign this charter for peace. Mr. Wellington Koo sat down, took up a brush, and inscribed his name in the ideographic characters of his country.
This is a great day for us all. As I proceed to sign the charter of the new security organization, in the name of the Republic of China, I am filled with emotion. I confidently...
It was noon in San Francisco when they started, but eastward, the day was older. It was 2 p.m. in Abilene, Kansas, when radio station KWBW rebroadcast an important event of the week. A local boy who made good and returned home from war. General Ike Eisenhower.
General Ike has removed his cap and is standing for the photographers now. The soil which we now know familiarly from seeing the general at his receptions in Washington, in New York, in Kansas City, yesterday at the airport, and now here is again flashing across this large audience here in Abilene, Kansas.
Mr. Mayor, Governor Schoeppel, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, because no man is really a man who has lost out of himself all of the boy, I want to speak first of the dreams of a barefoot boy. Frequently, they are to be a streetcar conductor, or he sees himself as the town policeman. Above all, he may reach the position of locomotive engineer. but always in his dreams, is that day when finally he comes home. Comes home to a welcome from his own hometown. We are a part of the great civilization of this world at this moment, and every part of the world where a similar civilization prevails is part of us. In a more definite way, since I am now a citizen of New York City, that city is part of you, one of your bigger suburbs.
Meanwhile, in New York that day, there were other signs that half the war was over, that the guns had been silent in Europe for just 48 days. In the steamy mid-afternoon heat, there was excitement on the waterfront.
New York is again wild with excitement today. I can see hundreds, no, thousands of people crowding as close to the piers as they can get. Cars have stopped all along the Battery. Perhaps you can hear the horns blowing. From here, it's a beautiful sight with two boats of the New York Harbor Fire Department sending huge streams in an arc with their hoses. A beautiful waterwork display, and right through the crossing arcs of water, you can see the Statue of Liberty. We're waiting for another contingent of soldiers and sailors coming home on the Queen Mary this past week. Yes, yes, there she is, the Queen Mary. I can see her making her way coming into New York past the Statue of Liberty. As I was saying, this past week, over 30,000 servicemen have returned home. And I understand she has about 12,000 Army and 2,000 Navy men aboard. Interesting thing, the Queen during the...
It was cool and cloudy as Big Ben sounded the hour, and the transmitters of the BBC carried a reassuring voice into every home, just as they'd done at every 9 p.m. during the anxious years.
Here is the news. The pace of the general election campaign was quickened today throughout the country. Mr. Churchill addressed meetings at Crewe, Manchester, Oldham, Huddersfield, and Leeds. At the Old Bailey, William Joyce, known as Lord Haw-Haw, was formally charged with high treason. The Ministry of Food announces that the tea ration will be increased immediately from 2 to 2.5 ounces per week.
It was 10 p.m. in Berlin, Vienna, Budapest. In all the cities of grief and hunger and desolation. From Vienna that day, Ernst Landsberger, an Austrian who'd been a secret agent organizing resistance to the Nazis in his country, telephoned this report.
The damage is very great. Our cathedral of St. Stephen, though still standing, is burned and scarred. The town hall, the parliament building, the imperial museum, and the Burgtheater are in ruins. There is no heating gas and only half an hour's electricity a day. The meals are being cooked on communal fires with food collected from the ruins. Garbage has not been collected for 6 months and is piled high in the streets. There have been outbreaks of typhus, and there are many graves in the parks and at street corners.
In Moscow, the red star above the Kremlin glowed silently in the fading daylight. People still talked of the great victory parade held in Red Square 2 days before, and at 11 p.m., Moscow radio broadcast the last news for the day.
Маршал Сталин был награжден Президиумом Верховного Совета СССР Орденом Победа. Затем ему было присвоено вновь учрежденное звание Генералиссимуса Советского Союза.
Маршал Сталин has been awarded the Order of Victory by the Supreme Soviet. He has been promoted to the newly created rank of Generalissimo of the Soviet Union.
Вы слушали радиопередачу Москвы.
In San Francisco, the great day still had 8 hours to run. It was 4 p.m.
Bert Seilin said a moment ago, the presidential party has reached the edge of the wings on the right-hand side of the stage as we face it from up here in the balcony, and we expect them to make their appearance out there in just a few moments. Edward R. Stettinius rapping the gavel on the podium, and the final plenary session is in order. Edward R. Stettinius, Jr., the Secretary of State.
Mr. President, fellow delegates, the final plenary session of the United Nations Conference on International Organization is now convened. We shall open this final session by standing in silence for 1 minute in tribute to all the men and the women of the United Nations Armed Forces, living and dead, whose courage and sacrifice have made this conference possible. Please arise.
The Ministry of Information announced today that total British Empire war casualties, including armed forces, merchant seamen, the British Home Guard, and British civilians, in 5 3/4 years of war, from September the 3rd, 1939, to May the 31st, 1945, totaled 1,427,634, of whom 532,233 were killed or missing or believed killed.
Ready to affix his signature to the charter was the chairman of the delegation of the United Kingdom, the Earl of Halifax.
There has been in the history of many countries a time when men have committed their thoughts, their hopes, and their prayers to what has seemed no more than a piece of paper. Whatever it was, such a piece of paper has become for all time a treasured possession because of its pledge and promise of the future.
United Kingdom, 233,042 killed, 57,472 missing, 275,975 wounded, prisoners of war, 183,849.
Dr. Herbert Evatt of Australia.
Everything depends upon the spirit with which that great task is begun and continued. With that spirit, this charter may mean and should mean the end of war upon this earth and the end of poverty in any portion of the earth.
Australia, 21,415 killed, 6,519 missing, 37,477 wounded, prisoners of war, 26,800.
Mr. V.M. Molotov, Foreign Minister of the USSR.
Если ведущие демократические страны покажут...
If the leading democratic countries show their ability to act in harmony in the post-war period as well, that will mean that the interests of peace and the security of nations have received at last a firm basis and protection.
USSR, 6,115,000 battle deaths, 14,012,000 wounded.
Mr. William Lyon Mackenzie King, the chairman of the delegation of Canada.
It is for each nation to remember that over all nations is humanity. It is for all to remember that justice is the common concern of mankind.
Canada, 36,018 killed. 2,866 missing, 53,073 wounded, prisoners of war, 9,051.
Monsieur Georges Bidault, the Foreign Minister of France.
Quelle figure ferions-nous? Quelle réponse ferions-nous si en rentrant chez nous, le cortège des héros, des martyrs et des innocents nous demandait qu'avez-vous fait de notre victoire, de notre sacrifice et de notre avenir?
France, 463,145 dead, 400,000 wounded, 140,000 missing.
Thus they spoke, the people's representatives, in the late afternoon of that great day at San Francisco. And over the wires, the cables, and the radios, their words went out to the world. Some, however, were out of the reach of radio.
No, we weren't getting any overseas news that day. Along with the rest of the Aussies, I was a bit busy, as I remember. We'd landed at Lutong in Sarawak about a week before, and I think on the 26th we'd pretty well cleaned up all the oil fields in West Borneo.
Yes, on that 26th of June, 10 years ago, For many, the war was still on. For some, there would be no more wars, or man-made peace either.
New Zealand Army casualties up to May the 31st. Total 33,015. Killed in action, 4,130. Died of wounds, 1,833. Wounded, 17,917.
However, in other parts of the world, there was some hope. Events were taking place which were to shape the pattern of post-war life, a pattern of national independence.
In India that day, we found ourselves standing midway between war and peace, between political dependence and sovereign nationhood. While Allied planes were taking off from our eastern airfields to bomb the Japanese in Burma, a political conference was in progress with the British in a hill city up north. This conference at Simla was not itself a success, but it paved the way for that rapid sequence of events which was to culminate, not so long after, in the establishment of two new sovereign nation states, India and Pakistan.
And other nations stood on the threshold of freedom too. Burma, Indonesia, Ceylon, the Philippines. The great day grew late at San Francisco, but the signing went on.
It is economic injustice, and even more social injustice, that has bred for all time in the past the great causes of war and have led to these great Armageddons. Let us not forget the vast emphasis that has to be laid on the causes that lead to war. Economic and social injustice.
That was Sir Ramaswamy Mudaliar of India.
India, 23,295 killed, 12,264 missing, 62,064 wounded, prisoners of war, 79,692.
It was now 4:30 in the afternoon, Pacific wartime, in San Francisco. More signatures to the UN Charter. One after the other, they came through the massed flags to the round blue table. New Zealand, Nicaragua, Norway, Panama, Peru, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Uruguay, Yugoslavia. And they signed.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. In just a moment now, we will switch to the stage of the War Memorial Opera House here in San Francisco to enable you to hear the final remarks of Field Marshal Jan Christian Smuts of the Union of South Africa.
To see that this great peace plan is backed with all their energy, all their heart, and all their soul. And so, in faith and trust, we hand down our charter to the future. And may heaven's blessing rest on it.
Fellow delegates, the President of the United States of America.
Okinawa, 11,260 killed. 33,769 wounded. Iwo, 4,630 killed, 15,308 wounded.
It has already been said by many that this is only a first step to lasting peace. That is true. Let us all have it firmly in mind that we start today from a good beginning, and with our eye always on the final objective, let us march forward.
Saipan, 3,426 killed, 13,099 wounded.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Preparatory Commission will meet at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning in room 230, 223 of the Veterans Building. And I now hereby declare the United Nations Conference on International Organization adjourned.
The total American casualties to date are 389,769 killed, 659,972 wounded, total 1,049,741.
The last name has been inscribed now. The Blue Barn Charter is closed. 153 signatures, the pledges of 50 nations to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, to reaffirm faith in human rights and the dignity of the human person, to practice tolerance and live together in peace, to promote social progress and better standards of life in larger freedom for all peoples.
When the session ended, I took a bus back to the office. I had a deadline to meet. The story wasn't difficult to write. It wrote itself, actually. But when it was finished, I found I was tense inside. Too tense to relax and plan for the next day's work. I went out of the office and walked around the streets for an hour, just looking at people. I knew that the fate of the United Nations, its success, depended upon them and not upon the diplomats at the Opera House.
So here we are, today, 10 years after the signing. Let's recall for a moment what the circumstances were that prevailed at the time when the organization came into being. The charter was signed in San Francisco in the closing days of the war. A weary and war-sickened humanity longed for a peace that would last. Quite naturally, it tended to mistake what was essentially a statement of high purposes for the achievement of those purposes. Too many mistook what was only the beginning of the road towards effective world organization for the end of it. In the mood of unconditional surrender of the spring of 1945, unconditional peace was a natural illusion. And inevitably, illusion bred disillusion. Yet, as a meeting place of all the world, the organization has survived the Cold War because the common instinct of self-preservation demands it. The Secretary General of the United Nations, Mr. Dag Hammarskjöld.
The United Nations, I mean the organization, is imperfect. It can be improved. The United Nations Charter no doubt has flaws. They can be corrected. But the concept of a world community of United Nations, the vision, the goal of our long journey from barbarism to civilization, is now a part of our lives. Let us make use of the United Nations, of this instrument we have created, to move further towards cooperation among the nations in strengthening peace and in helping our fellow men throughout the world to build a fuller, a more abundant life for all.
You've been listening to the United Nations radio production, A Great Day, a special broadcast commemorating the signing of the United Nations Charter at San Francisco 10 years ago. Wherever historical recordings were obtainable from United Nations archives, they were used on the program. In all cases where material was read by substitute voices, it was authentic and verified. Gibson Parker was the narrator.